I've told you often how much of an encouragement you are to me and to everybody that knows you. You're somewhat of a sort of special encouragement. Your singing is, I guess, one of the greatest encouragements that a preacher has as he stands before you to exhort and encourage you. But I thank God for you every day, and I ask your prayers on my behalf as I work with these men and their leading of you. You're good followers, and you're patient, and you're kind. 16 or 18 months probably before Jesus was killed, he took Peter, James, and John and went up into a mount, a high mountain, and there allowed them to witness a change in his structure, a change in his countenance at least. And he allowed them to witness his glory in a dimension that they had not been aware of. And his garments became white, whiter than any fuller's soap could brighten them. His face glistened, and they saw there the glory of the Lord. And then they came back down to the street level and were rudely reinserted into the realities of street level living, because immediately upon coming down out of the mountain, a man came up to Jesus with his epileptic son and said, "Sir, will you heal my son? I brought him to your disciples and they weren't able to heal him." And then Jesus said, "Oh, how long am I going to be with you? How long will I bear with you?" And so he said, "Bring the boy to me." He healed him. But we see a group of people gathered around watching these three men and their Lord return from a mountaintop experience, only to be confronted by the realities of a sin-sick and suffering world and by the impotency of a church or of a company of disciples who were rendered helpless because of their lack of faith. Now, last week, our meeting with Avon Malone was a mountaintop experience. We saw the glory of the Lord, I believe, in dimensions that we had not seen before. And we were praising and thanking God for that tremendous week of meetings and the proclamation of the gospel. And then this morning, we came down out of the mountaintop and were forced to get back down on street level living when one of the elders presented to us a challenge asking us to decide what degree we were going to be involved in terms of dollars and cents in alleviating the suffering of a sin-sick and darkened world. The sermon wasn't street level, Brother Gaines, but the challenge was. And then tonight, I want to challenge you with another street level challenge. And I want to set it in the background and setting of a man's life in the New Testament. And the peculiar thing about the man was his nickname. Well, that wasn't what was so peculiar about it. His life, there was something in his life that made them nickname him that. And we want to study this challenge in the light of that man. You know, nicknames are strange and interesting things. My generation was more prone, I think, to give nicknames to people than your generation is. Though I still consider myself to be the first one born in your generation. I still insist on that. As the years go by, though, it's harder to authenticate that and document it. But nevertheless, I still believe I know where you're coming from. But anyway, our people of my age, at least, were more prone to give nicknames. When I was a sophomore in David Lipscomb College, Ira North, the one and only Ira North, would give nicknames to all of his students in his classes. Now, he did this as a gimmick, I think, to his memory pegs. He couldn't remember our names, but he remembered these particular things about us, and he'd name us that. I was Mr. Song Leader. My wife, Louine, was Miss McGee from Tennessee. He didn't know, but he did know, but it rhymed with Tennessee, and so he got the name right. But anyway, he'd select these peculiarities or peculiar qualities and would assign them a nickname and then give it to us. And that way he remembered. When I was still younger, way back as just a lad of a boy, I used to run around with a group of people, or we were schoolmates, and so many of them had nicknames. One fellow that was such a He thought he was such a hot shot. His name was Watson, and they nicknamed him Hot Watt. Hot Watt Watson. And there was another boy in some years later that was known as Stud Kirkland, a great big old horse of a boy. And then another boy was skinny as a rail, and they named him Boneyard Allen. And I don't know what his Richard, I believe, was his first name, but we never called him Richard. And then there was Fats Domino and other people, you know, that had certain qualities about them that we identified and nicknamed. Mac the Knife and other things, you know, that we just, there were certain things about them that we thought, well, now that's just the way they are, so we called them that. You don't do that too much. However, we have named Jerry Jones the Mouth of the South, things like that, but we don't often do that. But outstanding characteristics, we identify and give nicknames. Today, as in no other time, perhaps in this generation, in the last two or three years, another phenomena has happened or has arisen, and it's the CB radio world. And they don't give each other nicknames, but the people themselves give themselves nicknames, but they call it a handle. Betty Ford, she's First Mama. That's her handle, because she's the first lady of the nation. And she chose to call herself as her handle, First Mama. And you could multiply that by about 50 million, I think they say, that are in the United States now. Everybody has his own handle. But the peculiar characteristic of nicknames or handles is that they zero in on a particular quality of a person that's outstanding and unique, and they characterize or they capitalize on that and call themselves or somebody else this particular quality, and it becomes their handle or their nickname. The man I want to talk to you about tonight, we first met him in Jerusalem. His name is Joseph of Cyprus. And if you're not familiar with that, it's because he didn't ever go by that name. He always went by his nickname. But we met him first in Jerusalem as he assisted the church there by selling a piece of property and giving the money of that that was brought from that property, laying it at the apostles' feet, and relieving the afflictions of the poor people in Jerusalem. You know him better by the name Barnabas, but he was simply Joe from Cyprus. Joseph of Cyprus was his name, but you never call him that. You call him Barnabas, just like I do. Probably you know him best, and maybe many of you know him only as a man who was generous with his money. But that was only one of his characteristics. That was only one of his qualities. And actually, that was incidental. That was not his major outstanding characteristic, not being generous with money. It was something else. But I would like to just say on the side that we ought to imitate that characteristic of him, that of generosity with his money. Dr. Gainis this morning stole my thunder. I was going to mention him and simply say that we as students, or you as students, those of us who are resident people, but particularly those of you who are students, don't answer by saying, but look, I don't have any money. I'm just a student. I don't have much money. But he knocked that thing clear out of the ballpark. You've been throwing the elders that curve for several years. Look, we don't have much money. But he saw that thing coming. He just reared back and knocked it clean over the sign in center field. I don't think you'll throw him that curve anymore. He found you out. He talked about when you went to the pizza parlor and when you went to the movies and when you go to see the Overland stage. And he laid all these things right in your lap and then challenged you to not let that plate pass by and you let it go by empty. So he got to us this morning on that score. But you ought to imitate this man Joseph in his generosity with money. But the thing that was so characteristic about Joseph didn't really have to do with money. It had to do with people. Joseph was a man who was generous with people. That's the beautiful characteristic of the man Joseph from Cyprus. Now, that's his characteristic. That's why the apostles named him Barnabas, son of encouragement. They named him that. He didn't name himself that. They nicknamed him Barnabas, son of encouragement, because he was so outstanding in this area. Now, there are two kinds of people that I want to mention today that Joseph was particularly aware of. Number one, Joseph, or Barnabas, was an encourager of the outsider, the stranger, the person, it seems, from whom we tend to shy away, those odd people that we don't really feel comfortable about. But this is seen in his treatment and his actions toward Saul of Tarsus. Saul of Tarsus was one of these outsiders that Barnabas befriended. In the 9th chapter of the book of Acts, I want to read just a few verses there. I want to do what Avon Malone couldn't do. I'm going to read. After the conversion of Saul, in verse 26 of chapter 9, it says, "And when he, that is Saul, had come to Jerusalem, He tried to join the disciples, and they were all afraid of him, for they didn't believe that he was a disciple. But Barnabas took him and brought him to the apostles and declared to them how on the road he had seen the Lord, who spoke to him, and how at Damascus he had preached boldly in the name of Jesus. So he went in and out among them in Jerusalem, preaching boldly in the name of the Lord. Now this was the action that Barnabas manifested and the attitude that he manifested toward this man, Saul of Tarsus. The church in Jerusalem was scared of Saul. And do you wonder why? He was the one that just in the very first verse of this ninth chapter, the record says, and Saul, still breathing threats and murder against the disciples of the Lord, went to the high priest and asked for him letters to the synagogues at Damascus, so that if he found any belonging to the way, men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem. That's the last they had heard of him. Here he was on the way to Damascus. They knew he had gone to the elders in Jerusalem and gotten letters so that he might bring back anybody from Damascus to Jerusalem, bound in chains, so that he might throw them in prison. That was their only real picture of this man Saul of Tarsus. And now here all of a sudden, he appears on the city limits of Jerusalem wanting to be a part of the church in Jerusalem. While the church wasn't going to let... While they were so scared of him, they didn't think he was a disciple, you see. They thought this was a ruse. They thought this was a trick. They thought if they let him in, all of a sudden he'd have the place surrounded and they would all be in prison. So they didn't warm up to him very fast. History, secular history, and mainly I guess it would be tradition, they describe the Apostle Paul's physical characteristics. I don't know whether they do him justice or not. If they did, then Saul was in real bad shape. They picture him as a hunchback with bowed legs, a hooked nose, red hair, and one or two other odd characteristics. He looks something like the hunchback of Notre Dame, is what I get from the pictures that are described of him there in tradition and in secular. Well, it's just tradition, I think. It's not secular history, but tradition. But Barnabas didn't accept Paul like that. He went to where Paul was. You get the picture now. Saul of Tarsus trying to make an inroad into the church. He wanted to be on the inside, but they left him on the outside. Except for one man, and that was this man Barnabas. He went to where Paul was. And four things he did that I want to mention just briefly. Four things that characterized this man who was an encourager of outsiders. Number one, by going to where the Apostle Paul was, or where Saul of Tarsus was, he laid himself open to be hurt. You'll just have to admit it. He didn't know whether Saul of Tarsus was true or not. I doubt that he had any more information than the rest of the people in the city of Jerusalem. He laid himself open to be hurt. Let me tell you something. There's no greater ingredient of friendship than that one single thing. You can't establish a meaningful relationship with somebody else without leaving yourself open to be hurt. As long as you keep your shield up, as long as you keep it at an arm's length, as long as you keep it to where you're not going to really let them get to you, you'll never establish a meaningful relationship with anybody. And I just simply say, take note of this man. He left himself wide open to be hurt. What if the Apostle Paul, or what if this man had been an imposter? Well, Barnabas would probably have been hurt. But Barnabas was saying, that's all right. I'll take that chance. You need an opportunity to be heard. And so he just simply did that, and he left himself open to be hurt. Secondly, he listened to the Apostle Paul. He listened to Saul of Tarsus. How do you think he had all this information here? How do you think he got the information that he took back to the apostles? He got it by listening. Someone said, my mind's already made up. Don't confuse me with the facts. That wasn't Barnabas's attitude. This man left himself open to the facts, and that simply means he left himself open to the truth. I don't believe genuine discipleship can be achieved without leaving yourself open to the truth. Many, many people who are members of the church keep their minds completely closed, locked up, and the key thrown away, so much as to say, my mind is already made up. Don't tell me any of the facts. My mind's already decided. I know what I believe. Don't confuse me. That's not good. Barnabas wasn't like that. He kept his mind open to the truth. A third characteristic of this man, he was willing to honor another person and point out another person's merit. Now that's fantastic when you look at what it cost him. This man was willing to honor another person and to point out their merit, even when their merit exceeds the value or the degree of his own merit. For example, look here in verse 27, Barnabas took him and brought him to the apostles and told them how on the road he had seen the Lord, who spoke to him. and how at Damascus he had preached boldly in the name of Jesus. Now that's coming from a man telling about another man's honor or his merit and taking sides and standing up and saying, now this man has seen the Lord. Now I want to ask you a question. Do you think that the man Barnabas had as outstanding a conversion as Saul of Tarsus had? I doubt it. I doubt that Barnabas would be able to say, now I know Paul saw the Lord on the road to Damascus, but I've seen him twice. No. There's no indication that Barnabas had any peculiar conversion at all. And yet he was willing, in the presence of his mundane, uneventful conversion, he was just a normally converted person. By the way, you can't deny his conversion. He's the most like the Lord Jesus Christ of any man that I think is recorded in the New Testament. Barnabas is the most Christ-like character that I see recorded in the first century church. You think about it. No, his conversion was genuine. It just wasn't out of the ordinary. But here he came, a common, everyday man, whose conversion, though it was genuine, was nothing to brag about, telling these apostles, look here, this man saw the Lord on the road to Damascus. He spoke to him, and now he has been proclaiming Jesus in the synagogues of Damascus. Isn't that fantastic? And they listened to him. He was willing to honor another person and sing the praises of his merit, even in the face of his own being just common and mundane. But then fourthly, this man was willing to encourage Paul to become. After the church spread from Jerusalem and went on down to Antioch of Syria and began to fan out across the west or the eastern Mediterranean sea coast, the man Barnabas went over into Antioch of Syria and then went on over into Antioch of Syria and then on over into Tarsus, where the apostle Paul lived and where he was staying at this present time. Barnabas went over there, looked for Paul, found him, brought him back to Jerusalem, settled him into a church where he could really and truly do his most effective work, and encouraged him and said, come on, Paul, do your thing now. You use your talent. Get in there and be one of the teachers. And sure enough, he took the initiative to go get Saul of Tarsus to bring him back. Now, that means something. That's real, genuine friendship. That's real encouragement. And he did this at the expense of his own position. Let me show you what I mean. In 13 and in 11 and verse 30, you find the arrangement there, Barnabas and Saul. Number one, Barnabas. Number two, Saul. In 14 and 14, you have the same arrangement, Barnabas and Paul, though it had become there. Barnabas and Saul, Barnabas and Paul. But then on over in chapter 15, it says that it was Paul and Barnabas. Paul and Barnabas. And I think that's found, in about chapter 15 and verse 2. And when Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and debate with them, Paul and Barnabas and some of the others were appointed to go up to Jerusalem to the apostles and elders about this question. So you find this man encouraging this outsider, even to the extent that it took away from his own importance, and Paul supplanted him as probably the prominent one in this duo or in this team of evangelists. Barnabas and Saul, Barnabas and Paul, and then Paul and Barnabas. But it didn't seem that Barnabas cared. Now I want to ask you a question. How ready are you to welcome the outsider? How ready are you to do like this man and welcome the stranger? Can you do that? You know, old Freddie Fumble is a freshman this year. He's right here on the Harding campus. He's got 5 thumbs on each hand and 6 toes on each foot. Freddie Fumble, he couldn't catch a football if he had to. He couldn't catch a baseball except in his mouth. Probably he'd miss it, everything but his head. He just can't do much. How are you going to treat him? When you were a child or a boy or a girl, did you ever have a group of kids and you choose up sides? I'll take Joe, I'll take John, I'll take Alice, I'll take Mary. And, you know, one man on each side is the chooser. And then there's this fellow, and he just stands there, you know, and he watches this one be gone, and that one, and that one, and that one. And finally, Freddie Fumble standing there in bold relief, just standing there. And the man whose unfortunate privilege it was to be his choice at that time says, oh, well, come on, Freddie. We might as well lose today as any time. Really makes him feel great, doesn't it? Fred is here on the campus. What are you going to do with him? Sally Smell, she's a sophomore. That's right. She transferred here from Farmers Union. What are you going to do with her? She doesn't know what deodorant is. She just never has been told. She just came off the farm, and she just doesn't know that you're supposed to use that stuff. What are you going to do with her? She may be your roommate. How are you going to treat her? I tell you what, you're going to have to look at yourself and see how you treat these people who are outsiders and who need your help. Juanita Wallflower, she's here. And you boys are going to have to be the ones that deal with her. How are you going to treat her? Listen, there's a whole core of Juanita Wallflowers that will probably never be asked out on a date unless you boys do more than what is normally expected of the world to do. Unless you're willing to go and see these fine Christian girls, maybe they aren't any moving star. But so what? Look underneath that mask, look underneath that face, and you're going to find some absolutely fantastic Christian women. There's a girl that I was in school with. I don't even remember her name, but she was as ugly as homemade sin. Man, she really was not a beauty until I got to know her. And I'll tell you what, there's never been a prettier girl in the world to me than that woman. She married a fine Christian man. They've got about five children. I think she married a doctor or something, and she's one of the finest Christian women that I've ever known. But she wasn't very nice to look at, Juanita Wallflower. And you're going to have to decide what you do with them. Old Homer Homely, he's here too. And when you girls, when he asks you for a date, you know, you can shoot him out of the saddle. That's your prerogative. You can do that. And don't think that a lot of you don't do it. Old Homer Homely, he's so self-conscious about it that he probably won't ask you for a date because he's been turned down so many times. There are people like this. The Jerusalem church was a lot like the church here, or we're a lot like the church in Jerusalem. The Jerusalem church consisted of people from all over the world who had come into this congregation, the local church in Jerusalem, and now they were there. We're like that too. You've come from all over the world. There are people here from practically every state in the Union and some 23 or 24 foreign countries. What are you going to do about it? You see, Barnabas, bless his heart, he wasn't a Jerusalemite. Barnabas was from somewhere else. He was from Cyprus. But what Barnabas did, though he was from outside, he came to Jerusalem and became a part of the inside and then began to reach out to the outside. That's what's so unique about this young man. Someone said the major difference between those who are mentally ill and those who are mentally well lies in the difference between people always going around looking for somebody to love them and then those people going around looking for somebody to love. Now, what characterizes you? There are a lot of people who spend their life going around clamoring for somebody to love them. And that's one of the major characteristics of mental illness. On the other hand, there's a whole slew of people today going around looking for somebody to love. That's mental health. And if you want to see a real fine line and clearly distinguished between mental health and mental illness, there it is. And if you're one of those that goes around constantly looking for somebody to love you, you're on the verge of mental illness. But if you're always looking for somebody to love, then you're in pretty good mental health. Barnabas was like that. Though he was an outsider, he was a Cyprusite or a Cypriot. He came to Jerusalem. He then became an immediate instrument to reach out to those people who were on the outside and to bring them in. So may I urge you, go out of your way at your own expense and say to the person who's on the outside, come in, we want you to be a part of us. That's what Barnabas did with outsiders. But the second kind of person that he showed such a friendship to and was so warm toward, and that was the backslider. The backslider. Barnabas was an encouragement to the backslider. This is seen in the way that he treated John Mark. In John Mark's case, this man was one of the ones who went with Paul and Barnabas on their first journey. And in chapter 13 and verse 13, now Paul and his company set sail from Paphos and came to Perga in Pamphylia. And John left them and returned to Jerusalem. You know why he went back to Jerusalem? Because his mama was there. That's where she lived. John Mark's mother had a house in Jerusalem. And we know this from some other information in the book of Acts chapter 12, I think it is. John Mark's mother was there in Jerusalem. John had a culture shock. He went through this culture shock and he couldn't stand it. When they landed in Perga, in Pamphylia, he left, went back home. This didn't set well with Paul. I don't think it set well with Barnabas. But here was Barnabas' attitude toward John Mark. He was willing to give John Mark a second chance. Paul wasn't. But what a beautiful characteristic of Jesus Christ it was. Now watch. When this happened, on over in chapter 15, look if you will, in chapter 15, verse 36. And after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, come, let's return and visit the brethren in every city where we've proclaimed the word of the Lord and see how they are. And Barnabas wanted to take with him John called Mark. But Paul thought not best to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. And there arose a sharp contention, so that they separated from each other. Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of the Lord. Now, this choice that Barnabas made of John Mark cost him Paul's immediate companionship. Paul and Barnabas were very close friends. But this man made a choice regarding a man that had been a backslider, and he knew that this man needed him more than Paul needed him. And so he said, all right, I'll pay the price. I'll forfeit and I'll forego the right of your association, Paul, in order to do someone else some good that needs me worse than you need me. Fantastic. When Barnabas said, I think we ought to take him, Paul said, I don't think we ought to. Barnabas said, I think we should. Paul said, I don't think we should. And it got so hot that they just simply split. Let me tell you what Barnabas could have said to Paul. He could have said to Paul, Paul, wait a minute. Have you forgotten some years ago when you were on the outskirts of Jerusalem and people wouldn't give you a hearing? Do you remember what happened there? I came to you and listened to you specifically and went back to the church in Jerusalem and I gave them a good report on you so that you might do your work. Don't you remember that? Have you forgotten that? And here we see a chink in Paul's armor. I don't think he's proud of it. How often, though, we do the same thing. How often we claim for ourselves what we refuse to give to another. That's true. And how often we would simply deprive someone of the very thing that we ask and demand for ourselves. And that's what we find Paul here doing. But you know what? Something else happened. When Barnabas made this decision about John Mark, some other group withdrew from him in a sense, and that was the church at Antioch. Look at verse 39. Verse 40. Well, that last part of 39. And there arose a sharp contention, so that they separated from each other. Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus. Period. But Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of the Lord. Now, what does that say? It just simply says that the church in Antioch sided with the Apostle Paul and Silas. That's what it says. It just simply says they took a picture of Paul and Silas as they were getting on the ship waving. There went Paul and Silas going over to thus and such, and they were sent out by the grace grace of the Lord, or commended to the grace of the Lord by the church in Antioch. And then way on the back page, down by the obituaries, it says, and Barnabas and John Mark also left town. That's all it says about them. Now, brethren, if I'm reading into it, stop me. But I don't think I am. It says Barnabas took John Mark and they went to Cyprus. But Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of the Lord. It just simply indicates that the church in Antioch, they also sided with the Apostle Paul. So what it amounts to is that this decision by Barnabas cost him not only Paul's immediate companionship, it cost him the, what you might call, the approval of the whole church in Antioch. And they sided with Paul, and Barnabas and John Mark just simply went away unnoticed. But he said, that's all right, I'll pay that price too. I believe I'm doing what's right. And you know what? Time has proved Barnabas right. They were wrong. Paul was wrong. That's right. The church in Antioch, if they were the ones that sided with Paul, they were wrong. Because time proved Barnabas right, both in regard to Paul and in regard to John Mark. He was right in terms of both of them. For example, how many books did Barnabas write? Well, there's a book that is probably a spurious book. I don't know. It's one of the pseudepigrapha or one of the rejected writings, the Epistle of Barnabas. We don't have it in our canon. Whether he wrote it or not, let's just say that he didn't. We don't know whether he did or not. But how many books did Paul write? Well, he wrote 13 and maybe 14. Oh, I see what you mean. How many books did Mark write? Well, he wrote one of the Gospels. And though Barnabas didn't write a single book that we have any record of here in the canon, he was the encourager of two men who wrote, in terms of the number of books, at least half of the books of the New Testament. Paul wrote either 13 and maybe 14. John Mark wrote one. That's 14 or 15 books out of the New Testament these two men wrote. And old Barnabas was standing right there in the middle of them saying, come on, do your thing. Come on, I'll take you to the elders and we'll talk, and come on, you can go with me on a missionary journey. And dog is no wonder they called him the son of encouragement. He was always encouraging people to be able to use their talents. I call him the perennial hothouse. He was absolutely a constant incubator. where people were allowed to be what they are, but they weren't content to be that. He encouraged them to become what God wanted them to be. That's what he did. A lot of people that are content to just let people be like they are. But this man, Barnabas, was always encouraging people to become what God wanted them to be. He was the son of encouragement. Well, how ready are you to do that? How ready am I to do what's right, regardless of what it costs us? Not just in terms of this thing of Barnabas and encouraging other people. That was the major emphasis here. It cost him Paul's companionship. It cost him the association of the church there, or their approval. But are you willing to stand up for what's right, even though it costs you your best friend? Are you willing to do what's right, even though it costs you the approval of your associates, the majority of the people with whom you run, the majority of society? Are you willing to stand up and say, I'm going to do this because I know it's right? How willing are you to give people a second chance? Are you gifted in the art of alienation or gifted in the art of reconciliation? This man was a perennial peacemaker, not a peace lover. He was a perennial peacemaker. Had he been just a peace lover, he never would have stuck his neck out for Saul. Had he been a peace lover only, he never would have stuck his neck out for Barnabas, because all it did was cause confusion immediately until he was proved right. Barnabas, son of encouragement. Will you give people that second chance? Oh, how we need it. We're sitting right slap dab in the middle of a situation like this that surrounded the Apostle Paul and Barnabas. How we need people that will reach out and say, that's all right, I'll listen to you. I'll take the chance. I'll leave myself open to be hurt. I'll be willing to give you honor. I'll sing the praises of your own merits, and I'll encourage you to be what you are and to become what you ought to be. I'll give you a second chance. All of these things were characteristic of this man, because this man was so much like Jesus of Nazareth, his Lord. He was almost like another Lord, another Jesus in every congregation where he went. He was constantly a positive encouragement. Acts the 11th chapter says he was a good man. He was there with joy. He was full of the Holy Spirit. He was full of faith. All of these things are said about this man, Barnabas. Well, I commend him to you. He was a man who was always standing between people who were alienated and saying to them, now you need to listen, and you need to listen. Don't think that whenever he went to meet Saul of Tarsus and went out to the city of Jerusalem, to the city limits, and said to him, now, as he listened to them, don't think that he didn't say to Saul, now Saul, you need to be aware of the fact that Mrs. Stephen has been hurt. You murdered her husband. The church hasn't received you, fair enough, but you've put the husbands and wives of many of these people in jail. You understand that, don't you? You understand their reservation. You understand why they're hurt, and you're going to have to give them some time. And on the other hand, he went back to the church in Jerusalem and said, look, this man is genuine. He's had a real conversion. And so here he stood bringing people together. He was always this reconciler, bringing folks together. Beautiful character. Can you do that? Hope you say he was an active. Yes, he was, but he was full-time supported. Oh, no, not this man. He was occupied in secular work. In the Corinthian correspondence, Paul asked the Corinthians, is it just Barnabas and I that don't have a right to quit working? Barnabas was working just like Paul. But no, though he was occupied with some secular work, he was preoccupied with the kingdom of God, and that's the difference. There was a poem written about Barnabas, I think. He drew a circle and shut me out. Heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle and took him in. That was Barnabas. I want to ask you a question. What have your roommates and your schoolmates nicknamed you this year? Already, what have they nicknamed you? What has the church here nicknamed you? Stingy Gut Smith. Here comes the plea. Is that what they've nicknamed you? If they had to nickname you by what you've done already in contribution, what would they call you? Oh, there's old Stingy Gut Smith. Man, he's got every kind of money for everything else but the Lord. Don't let that be it, not after this morning. What has your roommate nicknamed you? Old Foul Mouth so-and-so. You're being nicknamed by somebody because of the way you are. I wonder what God would nickname us. Hey, I wonder what would happen if this side over here nicknamed these over here. Those of you who know these people over here, would you stand up and nickname them? Wouldn't that be a shock? Whew, what a revelation. But you're writing the name of your nickname across your forehead by the way you live your life. What are they nicknaming you? Now, let me urge you, be a Barnabas. There's so many people that are on the outside looking in. There's so many people who are backsliding, and they've come forward during this meeting. And the reason why I've spoken on this today is because we're living in a living situation where people who are Barnabases are needed in this community, in this school community, in this town community. We need them. There are a lot of people who've moved into these into this community who are members of the church, who are families, and they've moved in here just hand over fist. And the resident members here need to be Barnabases. You need to take them a pie or a cake. You need to call them up. We need to get in there and make these people feel like they're part of us. Let's not miss this opportunity. It's too great. Now, if you're here tonight and you need to respond somehow or other, whatever it may be, if there are any who haven't responded during this past week, we've had a whole slew respond this past week. Is there anybody left that needs some kind of an opportunity to express yourself and your need, if you are here and you have that need? Or if you'd like to become a Christian and be a part of this body here, listen, this is the time. If your faith is sufficient to make you confess your faith in Christ and be baptized into Him for the forgiveness of your sins and be a part of this body and then begin reaching out to help others, if that's what you are ready for, then we urge you to come. And those of us who are Christians already, be sensitive to the outsider. Be sensitive to the backslider. Be a Barnabas, son of encouragement. He was a fantastic man. He was like his Lord, and we all ought to strive to be more like that every day. May God grant us that grace. We want to all now serve as a Barnabas as we stand to sing this song of encouragement. Let's all be a Barnabas while we sing this encouragement.
Oh, to be like thee, blessed Redeemer, this is my constant longing and prayer.